Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings the globe to your ears through original documentary storytelling. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 20th of September, these are our main stories. President Zelensky has warned that Russia is a threat to the whole world in his first in-person speech at the UN General Assembly since the invasion of Ukraine. Azerbaijan has said it won't stop its assault on the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh until ethnic Armenian separatists surrender. And one of Colombia's largest remaining rebel groups has agreed to a ceasefire and renew peace talks. Also in this podcast,
only a very small fraction of the missense mutations are known to be either benign or disease-causing. With our model, that proportion goes to 89%.
Researchers have developed a tool that uses artificial intelligence to identify DNA mutations that might cause diseases. First, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned world leaders that Russia's invasion of his country is a grave threat to the whole world. He was making his first speech in person at the UN General Assembly since Moscow's full-scale attack began last year. President Zelensky urged the US President Joe Biden and other allies present to remain united in backing Ukraine to ensure its victory.
We have to stop it. We must act united to defeat the aggressor and focus all our capabilities and energy on addressing these challenges. As nukes are restrained, likewise the aggressor must be restrained and all his tools and methods of war. Each war now can become final, but it takes our unity to make sure that aggression will not break in again.
Well, a short time before that, President Biden had warned the world leaders at the UN meeting to resist what he called Russia's naked aggression in Ukraine.
We have to stand up to this naked aggression today and deter other would-be aggressors tomorrow. That's why the United States, together with our allies and partners around the world, will continue to stand with the brave people of Ukraine as they defend their sovereignty and territorial integrity and their freedom.
But the audience for his address was missing notable counterparts, with France, the United Kingdom and Russia all not sending their leaders. I spoke to the BBC's Neda Torfik, who's in New York, and asked her, did it help that Mr. Zelensky was actually there in person?
Well, I mean, you can certainly tell that, you know, attention was going to be high, and certainly was. I mean, even when he came into the UN General Assembly, there was a swarm of press. He's been doing the press round, several interviews since he's been here. He got a standing ovation before and after his speech. So I think him being here in person has certainly highlighted what he has to say. It's given him that real platform. But as you say, it was a very familiar message. What he did note was that he is going to outline details of his peace proposal in a Security Council meeting. But we saw him holding bilateral meetings with the likes of South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa and others who haven't been as outright in condemning Russia for its invasion. So I think him being in person, being able to speak face to face with these people, he's hoping it does have an impact.
There is other topics, clearly, climate, I think sustainable development goals. But is the truth that this meeting is all Ukraine, Ukraine, Ukraine?
Well, certainly the next several days, there are going to be attention on President Zelensky's movement. As I mentioned, the Security Council meeting. Then he goes off to the White House on Thursday to meet with Joe Biden there and congressional leaders who are a bit conflicted on the Republican side about continued aid. So I think we're going to see eyes focused on him. But we really have been seeing leaders and others focusing on things like climate. And it is getting a decent amount of attention here.
Neda Torfik in New York. Azerbaijan says it will continue its military assault on Nagorno-Karabakh until Armenian separatists there surrender. Officials in the disputed territory say 25 people have been killed and more than 80 injured since fighting broke out early on Tuesday. Azerbaijani forces have launched artillery, missile and drone attacks in the breakaway enclave, which is recognised internationally as part of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan insists it was forced to take action after six of its citizens were blown up by landmines. But a spokesperson for the administration running the enclave, Gegem Stepanian, said Azerbaijan wants to ethnically cleanse Armenians from the territory.
Azerbaijan is using all kinds of weaponry, starting from artillery, rockets, UAVs. They are targeting not only a military object, but also civilian communities. They are calling this attack counter-terrorist operation, but this is nothing else than a bloody stage of Azerbaijani genocidal policy.
Well, for more on this brewing conflict, I heard from our Caucasus correspondent, Rayhan Dimitri.
It's increasingly looking like it's a major military operation taking place in Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan has launched what it described as an anti-terror operation. And it looks like Azerbaijan is determined to establish full control of its breakaway region, populated by 120,000 ethnic Armenians. We're trying to piece together the picture of what's happening. And that, of course, we're looking at social media and the videos that are being posted. So there are reports of casualties among the civilian population, including children. And one video which I saw showed the main hospital in Stepanakert, which is the regional capital, showing a kind of chaotic scenes and more injured people being delivered there. However, Azerbaijan claims that it is specifically targeting only military infrastructure. It issued a warning to the ethnic Armenian population, asking them to seek cover and saying that they will not be harmed. Armenia is describing this as ethnic cleansing, and it says that the aim of this military offensive by Azerbaijan is to drive ethnic Armenians out of the territory.
So can you just clarify, despite Azerbaijan saying it is targeting military installations, it gave a warning, as you just reported, there are some reports of civilian casualties, including children.
That's correct. Yes, civilian casualties, and that number is rising. So it's really difficult to say how many are now. The latest figure I saw was 25, and two of them were civilian casualties. There has been a growing international pressure on Azerbaijan from the EU foreign policy chief, from the German chancellor, and a number of other European nations. And they're all calling on Azerbaijan to immediately stop its military offensive and return to negotiations. They're saying that Baku should talk directly with Karabakh Armenians. But Baku is saying that it is ready to hold talks on its territory with representatives of the Armenian community of Nagorno-Karabakh. However, it says that it will continue its anti-terror operation until the local government, which it calls a puppet regime in Stepanakert, surrenders and disarms fully.
Rayhan Dimitri. A former member of Belarus's security forces has told a Swiss court how his unit abducted three opposition activists in 1999 before killing them. At his trial, Yuri Garavsky said he was involved in snatching the men from the streets of Minsk, but he told the court several times that he was not the gunman. Sarah Rainsford has more.
Yuri Garavsky arrived in court with police protection and his hood pulled down low over his eyes because he says the testimony he's giving here has put his own life in danger. The former Special Forces soldier has confessed to taking part in the abduction of three men in Belarus in 1999. All three were killed. They were opponents of Alexander Lukashenko, who was then tightening his grip on power. Today, two daughters of the disappeared sat and hugged in the front row, just metres from the man who described how his secret unit had snatched their fathers from the streets of Minsk. He said both had been killed, with two shots each to the back.
We're going to go to Libya now, where the World Health Organization says more than 400 migrants are among those who'd lost their lives in last week's devastating floods in the east of the country. The organization said the figure came from deaths reported by Libyan hospitals. Thousands of African and Middle Eastern migrants are temporarily based in Libya, with many hoping to reach Europe from there. Estimates of the overall number of people who died in the storm vary widely, but hospital reports put the figure at around 4,000. Many died in the coastal city of Derna, where torrential rain caused two dams to collapse, triggering catastrophic flooding. On Monday, the house of the ousted mayor of the city was torched and there were large protests. Now journalists are being told to stay away from Derna. Rebecca Kesby spoke to the BBC's Anna Foster on Tuesday. She's one of those who had been in the city but was asked to leave.
Well, we've been operating in Derna for several days now, and we've noticed as more and more journalists have arrived, it has become a little more difficult in terms of getting permission to go in and operate in the city. We heard late last night a rumour that the journalists weren't going to be allowed to operate in Derna anymore, and in fact that was the case today. Local journalists, international journalists were asked to leave. I think the timing is quite interesting because there were protests in Derna last night, protests against the Eastern-based administration, people very unhappy with their leadership, feeling like they'd failed when it came to things like maintaining those dams that burst and allowed all of that water to flow through Derna, washing so much of it away. And then less than 24 hours later, we see this crackdown on reporting from the city. We saw a real communications blackout this morning, you know, areas that we were moving through that had had patchy but existent phone reception and data were now completely out of contact. And really now we're sort of waiting and watching to see what the authorities will do. They said that there were too many people in Derna hampering the recovery effort. That was their excuse for doing this. So we'll look to see whether this is something that changes, that goes back in the next few days, or whether indeed they are trying to seal this city off when it comes to reporting and to finding out what's going on in there.
What's been your experience with local people when you've been talking to them? Have they been happy that you've been there to report the story?
In situations like this, you know, often people, they appreciate the opportunity to actually talk about what has happened to them and to let the wider world know what has happened to them. And of course, when people don't, we sort of leave them in peace. I don't feel like I've seen journalists particularly getting underfoot. I mean, there have been a lot of volunteer workers as well, people from different parts of Libya who've come across and who've been involved in that recovery effort, including people who have come from the West, from Tripoli. And there are some suggestions, again, I don't know how much truth there is in this, that now perhaps the Eastern-based authorities don't want people from the West to be here anymore, given that split that there is in Libya, given that you have these two rival administrations, that they perhaps have accepted that early help, but they want to try and return to the old order a little bit now.
Anna Foster in Libya. Japan has long been engaged in a struggle to provide for its ageing population. It has one of the lowest birth rates in the world. Just how acute the problem is illustrated by new data, which for the first time shows that more than 1 in 10 people in Japan are now aged 80 or over. Tim Franks spoke to Dr. Paul Moreland, a demographer and author of the forthcoming book Procreate or Perish.
Well, the Japanese Prime Minister has talked about civilizational collapse, and I think we have to give him the a credit for knowing what he's talking about. Japan is at the cutting edge of what the rest of the world is heading for, which is what happens when you've had 50 or 60 years of too few births, and significantly too few in the case of Japan, and an extending life expectancy. We should celebrate the extending life expectancy, and the Japanese have done a fantastic job at keeping people alive. But if you're not having the children to support that aging population, it's going to be a disaster.
And the turnaround in figures is utterly stark, isn't it? I mean, I was reading, I think, the figures are from some research that you've done, but about, you know, the number of young people there were for every elderly person back in the 60s and how that has changed.
Yes, when Japan hit 100 million people back in the mid-60s, there were 5 or 6 workers for everyone aged over 60. When it gets back to 100 million on the way down, which is going to be in the 2050s, there's going to be less than 1 person in their 20s to 60s to everyone over 60. How a society like that is going to function, where you have less than 1 person in work for every 1 retiree, it's very hard to fathom.
What are the answers? I mean, how far are countries such as Japan looking at other possible solutions like encouraging immigration?
Migration has been an incredibly important part of the picture for countries in Europe that are prepared to undergo rapid ethnic change. Japan is not prepared to do that, and Japan is a very distant and obscure culture for people in the high fertility parts of the world. It's not somewhere they understand, it's not somewhere they have communities. and mass immigration is not wanted in Japan. And even for those of us in countries like Britain that have had mass immigration, we have to realise that the fertility rates are dropping in countries like Poland, where we've traditionally recruited people from. So we're just moving pieces around on the chessboard. For Japan, the only answer is to increase its birth rate, its fertility rate per woman. And that requires not just government policy, and the government has been trying, but a complete cultural turnaround.
Right. And I guess the issue, I mean, you know, for people such as you who study these things, it's not just that this is sort of a pressing need right now, but I mean, it's something that's going to need quite a sustained effort, because presumably demographic trends are not something that you sort of, you change in an instant.
No, even if Japan's women now started having larger families, there are so few young women of fertile years in Japan. It's going to take a very long time to turn around. And that's because we've been sailing into this iceberg for 50 or 60 years and paying it almost no attention.
The demographer Paul Morland. Still to come.
Sometimes I can collapse. I can lose my sight in a flash. I can have a consistent pain that goes on for days on end.
We look at the debilitating condition of migraine after another sufferer said she was resigning as a British government minister because migraines meant she couldn't do her job properly.
I had just come out of one of my bare-knuckle boxing matches. I don't know why, but the first thing that came to my brain was, what if I do a drag show?
Remarkable personal stories told by the people that lived them.
I could easily have pulled that trigger, but that was not my brief. I was not an assassin. I was not told to do that. I was not told to murder him.
Lives Less Ordinary from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Pod. Now, to an area of India where ethnic tensions are extremely high. More than 200 people have been killed so far, and incidents of violence continue in Manipur state in the northeast of the country, where violence broke out between the majority Maitai and minority Kuki communities in May. It's a conflict marked by brutal murders and sexual crimes against women, which have shocked India and left the state deeply divided. Our South Asia correspondent, Yogita Lamai, went to Manipur.
This bloody conflict descended after months of tensions between the two communities over quotas and jobs in education, land rights and political power. In the first few days of the violence, those killed were overwhelmingly from the Kuki minority, and they still account for two-thirds of all casualties.
While the violence in Manipur started in early May, it only really came into both the national as well as the international spotlight in late July, when a video was circulated on social media which showed two women being paraded around naked by a mob of men. And the younger woman, in her 20s, was allegedly gang-raped afterwards. I'm about to meet the mother of the younger woman now. Her husband and her 19-year-old son were killed by the same mob.
Watching the video made me want to die. To see how my daughter was treated, to know what was done to my family. My husband's arms were slashed with knives. My son was in the 12th grade. He was brutally beaten with rods. They were killed in front of my daughter.
What we are seeing on both sides of this conflict in Manipur are civilians telling us that they feel like they have to pick up weapons to protect themselves, their families, their villages, their community. I'm at a bunker on the Kuki side, and it's essentially just a makeshift shed which has been propped up with bamboo sticks, and it has tin sheet for a roof. There are three people in front of me there who have guns, and they're pointing towards the other side, which is the Maithi side.
One man who works as a labourer told us why he was there.
It's up to us to defend ourselves now. We have no evil intentions. We do not want violence. But this has become necessary now because we don't trust the police or other security forces to protect us.
Less than a mile across the paddy fields, we also went to a very similar bunker on the Maitai side.
I am 26.
You're 26.
Yeah. In front of me right now, I can see four men. They all have big guns.
When did you learn how to fire a weapon?
2 months ago.
We've been struck by how many civilians we've seen carrying weapons, some even in front of Indian security forces. Their spokesmen didn't respond to the BBC's questions, but have claimed they are seizing illegal weapons. It's easy to understand how the enmity between the communities became so bitter and deep so quickly when you hear details of the violence. I've come now to a small house in the countryside to meet with the family of 33-year-old David Tolor, who was killed on the 2nd of July. His family says that he was killed by a mob of mighty men. We have seen a very graphic video, and I'm now going to speak to his brother, Abraham.
It was so painful seeing the video. I have trouble sleeping. I don't even keep his photos on my phone, because if I see them, it keeps coming back.
People from both sides of the conflict are expecting Prime Minister Narendra Modi's national government to step in and resolve the crisis. They've told us that they're disappointed that despite the severity of the violence, for months he didn't speak about it. And they say even now there are no concrete steps being taken on the ground, even though both the regional government of Manipur and the national government of India are run by Mr. Modi's party.
Yogita Limai, reporting from India's northeast. The Colombian government and the EMC rebel group have agreed to resume peace talks and implement a 10-month ceasefire starting next month. The first round of negotiations will be held near the border with Venezuela. Leonardo Rocha reports.
The EMC, or Estado Mayor Central, has about 3,000 members. It's the largest dissident faction from the FARC rebel group, which broke away when the FARC signed a peace agreement with the government in 2016 after 6 decades of fighting. President Gustavo Petro, a former Marxist rebel himself, has promised to break Colombia's historical cycle of violence by inviting all armed groups to peace talks. The EMC leader, Ivan Mordisco, initially refused to engage in negotiations, but he changed his mind after surviving a deadly attack against one of the group's camps a year ago.
Leonardo Rocha reporting. Now, head pain, fatigue, problems with your sight, all these are symptoms of migraine, a type of headache which can be so debilitating that people find it impossible to do their job. And this week, a British Member of Parliament, Dahina Davison, resigned in her job as a government minister, saying chronic migraines have made it impossible to do that job. But what's it like having chronic migraines, and how does it affect your life? James Reynolds spoke to two people who suffer from the condition, Kerry Spalding from Leicestershire in central England and Cynthia Kamuna from Nairobi in Kenya. First, Cynthia, and some people may find the following distressing.
Several things happen. So sometimes I can collapse. I can lose my sight in a flash. I can have a consistent pain that goes on for days on end. One of the examples I could share is I've had once a migraine that went for about 31 days of consistent pain without any ease. So it's crippling. It affects your work. It affects your social life. It affects your way of life. And it's not an easy issue to deal with, especially if you're working in a very busy environment.
It sounds terrible, particularly that 30-odd day attack that you had. And let's bring in Kerry here in England. You've just heard Cynthia describe the excruciating pain that she goes through. How is it for you?
Actually, there's several different types of migraine that people can suffer from. I'm a vestibular migraine patient, which all sounds very familiar to the other sufferer that's just been talking. I get persistent vertigo as well. So I have vertigo where it feels like it's spinning on the inside of my body and on the outside of my body, which then causes me to vomit constantly. And that can last for days on end. I think the longest bout I've had is like 7 days, literally vomiting night and day. My attacks can last anywhere up to 6 weeks at a time. I also go blind. I have to stay in a dark room. Can't bear any light at all. I can't bear any noise at all. So I just become completely debilitated in bed and completely isolated from the world, unable to work, socialise, and basically, you know, get out of bed.
Well, vivid descriptions there of severe symptoms from migraine sufferers Kerry Spalding here in England, and before her, Cynthia Kimuna from Nairobi in Kenya. Now, the artificial intelligence company Google DeepMind has used its technology to identify mutations in human DNA that might cause diseases. The development is expected to speed up efforts to find new, more effective drugs for conditions such as brain disorders, heart disease and cancer. Our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh, has more.
Our DNA contains the information to build bodies. It contains repeated blocks of chemicals known by the initials A, C, T and G, and they have to be in a particular sequence. If there's a mistake in the order of the letters, it can lead to a faulty gene and cause disease. But there are billions of these blocks, and so far, scientists have identified a tiny fraction of the changes in order that lead to disease. Experts at Google DeepMind have developed an AI tool called Alpha MissSense that's about to make the search for faulty genes or mutations much easier. Pushmeet Kohli is in charge of the firm's drive to develop AI tools for science.
The knowledge that we have acquired till now is fairly limited. Only a very small fraction, 0.1% of the missense mutations are known to be either benign or disease-causing. With our model, that proportion goes to 89%.
DNA leads to the creation of the body's building blocks, which are called proteins. Last year, Google DeepMind's AI worked out the shape of nearly all of them. The new system can tell if the letters in the DNA will produce the correct shape. If not, it's listed as potentially disease-causing.
Pallab Ghosh reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can, of course, send us an email. The address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.